Welcome to the Investing Tutor Podcast, the show for professionals looking to master the most up-to-date strategies needed to build wealth and provide a stable financial future. Here's your host, Dr. Hans Boateng.
Hey friends, Dr. Hans here, the Investing Tutor, and as always, I have an incredible episode for you today. Joining us is my good friend, Kevin Matthews II. He launched Building Bread in 2010, and his goal is to help millennials achieve financial freedom. He's been featured in several media publications, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Business Insider. I mean, Kevin is everywhere. He's a two-time author, one-time bestseller, and he was rated one of the top 100 financial advisors in the country. You all, you are in for a treat, and I'm looking forward to our discussion today. Kevin, brother, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So yeah, brother, if someone is sitting with a portfolio, let's say they have your typical companies like, you know, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Salesforce, and let's say they have an S&P 500 and an S&P 500 growth stock, a growth fund. You know, what would you be saying to someone who has that and they are looking at, oh, I keep hearing on CNBC that this is the time for value stocks. You know, should I go in and then change things around? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say it depends on what you're looking to do. Are you trying to win the marathon or are you trying to win the sprint? Because right now, I think value stocks are going to be the winner over the next, let's say, 6 months, maybe, or at least the next 3 months or so. I think value is going to win. But this time next year, by the end of the year, I'm not so certain that that's going to be the case. So if you're already holding a lot of those legacy tech names, especially if you have an index fund like that, you're going to be fine. But do you want to reposition everything just to win for the next few months? Or are you looking to win the long game and win over the next 3 years?
Such a phenomenal point. You know, individuals tend to think short term, right? Because most new investors, they are looking at their portfolios because they came into investing more 2021, looking to replicate 2020's gains, and they are not seeing that right away. So many of them, they are trying to figure out, you know, should I be selling? Should I be moving? And to your point, value could be winning for the next 3 months, or it could win for the next 6 months. There's just no way to know. So the most important thing, which I'm sure you share with your students as well, is have a long-term focus and long-term trajectory so that when the market is moving in a particular direction, it's not influencing your particular investing strategy. And brother, I'm sure you're hearing a lot about inflation and how that is impacting interest rates, specifically the 10-year, treasury. What can you share with my listeners about that dynamic? Why is inflation spooking the market?
Yeah, so that's another really good question. And we have to realize that the economy is really interconnected. It's almost like a domino effect. So if inflation goes up, this sets off a chain reaction for the market and investors start to react. And the way this works is inflation, for those that may not know, that's the rising cost of goods, of stuff. So, you know, movie tickets, bread, milk, what have you. And what we don't want to have, and no one wants this, is where the prices of things just get out of hand, which is called hyperinflation. You go in, you buy a loaf of bread that's $5, 2 weeks later, it's $10, it's $15. That's not what we want. And inflation in the US doesn't happen like that. It doesn't happen that quickly, but we want to make sure that it's at a decent, good level. Well, who controls inflation? The Federal Reserve controls inflation by how they kind of manipulate that part of the market to keep inflation at a reasonable level. So here's how things work. If inflation goes up, then the Federal Reserve acts by raising interest rates. If they raise interest rates, stocks tend to fall. If stocks tend to fall, people sell stocks and move into bonds. So anytime there's interest rate spheres, the domino effect happens. People overreact. Oh my God, the Federal Reserve might do this. And if they do this, that means I need to get out of this stock and jump somewhere else, jump to bonds, jump to savings, jump anywhere else but where I am now. And we saw the opposite end of this last year when the Federal Reserve cut interest rates. That's one of the reasons why the market took off the way it did, because we all got those emails saying, hey, look, your savings rate, we're cutting it, right? So everything fell down from a savings rate perspective. And we all said, let's move to the market. Let's grow our money. So the fear of the opposite is happening. And that's one reason why people are rotating out of the stocks they used to be in to try and position themselves for a potential rate hike.
But the Federal Reserve has said that they are keeping rates low right until 2023. So why is the market reacting now?
The market could be irrational. I mean, that's really what it is at the end of the day. Because you're right, even if there's no way you cut interest rates all the way to zero, and they cut rates three times last year. You can't magically just raise rates after a day or after 90 days in the new year. So the market is kind of overreacting, not really thinking clearly, which happens. The market is not a logical place. You can ask GameStop that. And it happens. So yeah, I think it's really an overreaction. We did hear Jerome Powell speak on this not too long ago. And we knew this last year, you can check the articles, that we knew rates weren't going to raise quickly. So it's really just an overreaction, which is why I'm not selling the Apples, the Amazons, the Googles, the Microsofts that I've had, because there's nothing actually wrong with them at all. It's just the market overreacting to the news and reading the headlines a little too much.
Yeah. So what I kind of understand with the market, and I wanted to get your thoughts on this, is that, you know, in the short term, sentiments can kind of move the market, right? Mm-hmm. Investors or traders are expecting that the market is going to do something. And as a result of that, the market tends to trade in that particular direction. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, show me the money, meaning is more money moving into tech or is more money moving into value, right? The expectation is that most of these value stocks, you know, have been beaten down. And that as we reopen, they will regain in terms of, you know, more revenue, or as we're all coming out, we're going to be spending more money with most of these companies, whether it has to do with banks or even specifically with banks. As rates are increasing, then it means that banks can make more money on their deposits, right? Or they can charge, what's it called? Well, they can get higher rates on like credit cards and things like that. Mm-hmm. I've even lost my train of thought.
It happens, but I do agree on the bank point. Mm-hmm. I actually just recorded a video about how I think banks might be the best play right now for both like short to medium term, because mm-hmm. when we do know that now at this point of the pandemic, we've got 30 million people that are vaccinated. So it's like 1 in 10 or so. When these businesses open up and we travel more, these small businesses, the bars, the hotels, all these places have to hire more people. They have to open facilities. Perhaps they're going to add on a bit more to accommodate the additional people. They have to get that money from somewhere. And that's going to be a JP Morgan or a Bank of America, or even some of these smaller regional banks that most people don't think about. That could be a great place for these for revenue and for growth in the market. But also, in addition to the things you had mentioned earlier, we're not also thinking about them cutting losses, because last year we had so many people unemployed, they took a lot of credit losses. So people weren't paying their credit card bills because they couldn't afford to. There were a lot of mortgages that were about to be foreclosed and they weren't paying on that. Well, if they start to get their jobs back and things start to improve, they cut those losses and look a whole lot more profitable. So that's really what I'm looking for, that, you know, like a JP Morgan, that's a decent long-term investment, but I think in the short term it's going to look even better. For example, I think JP Morgan is up more than 20% just this year compared to the 5% that the S&P 500 is up.
Yeah. And I remembered what I was actually saying, which is, and you, that is such a great point that you shared, right? Because most companies have gotten an opportunity to restructure, right? Mm-hmm. So then they've been able to make their businesses very lean, So as, you know, money or capital or revenue begins to flow in from customers as we all come out, I mean, it can position some of these companies as being very attractive. Hence the reason why the market is looking at it as, hey, value stocks, value stocks. But I also have this core belief that it's not only these value players that are going to be getting the money, right? I mean, mm-hmm. people are still going to be buying iPhones. Like, right. that is not going to change. I mean, individuals are not going to be necessarily using Amazon less, right? I mean, even if it's a little bit less, not a lot. Not to mention that Amazon is still growing. I'm sure you're familiar with their new health expedition, right? Them mm-hmm. moving into the healthcare field, which is a $3 to $4 trillion market. And they are trying to get their piece of that market. So many of these tech players are looking at expanding. I believe Tesla, which we will talk about shortly, is looking at creating a new, you know, manufacturing facility in India, right? So the yeah. expansion is coming. So at the end of the day, money or revenue or earnings, if you will dictate who really wins. So that right. competition between value and growth, at the end of the day, it's show me the money, right? Right. I'm kind of still very bullish on the fact that tech is going to dominate in terms of capital. That's just how I feel.
Yeah, well, I think that sometimes new investors or sometimes even Wall Street actually forgets what all tech can actually do. And I think that's really important. So one of my biggest bullish positions, and I've said this since late last year, was that Google, I think, is going to be one of the breakout players of this year. They're already up 17% this year, but last year they did incredibly well, even though their biggest revenue generator, which is digital ads, was down. So because all these places were closed, they still made money. So you know, you could almost bank on it that they are going to do extremely well this year because all these businesses, again, whether it was a bike shop or a small hotel, bed and breakfast, you want to advertise and say, look, we're open. Please come and stay here. You got to do that on YouTube. You got to do that on Google Maps. You got to do that on Google Search. And the fact that the company can do so well without that, and you're adding their biggest revenue generator, it's hard to lose, in my view, on something like that. And I don't think everybody realizes it. I think it's like, oh, yeah, you know, tech's not great. Not realizing, like you said, you're still going to buy an iPhone. In fact, you're going to use your iPhone to Google things. So you can pay it either way.
That is such a good point. And as you're sharing that, and for everyone listening, do you see the analysis there, right? You have a company that was thriving, even though ads make up a big chunk of the company's revenue. Google still thrived very much last year. And most companies, whenever there is like a major economic hit, the first thing that they are cutting out of the expense line item is marketing and ads and things of that nature. So then coming out of the pandemic, you could see that increase, right? They are marketing more, they are running more ads, and that is going to add to Google's revenue. Also, I know they are really big on Waymo, which is, I mean, we're talking like autonomous taxi networks. I believe Cathie Wood is valuing that anywhere between, I believe I've heard 3 trillion, I've heard 7 trillion. I mean, they throw the trillions around like it's just chump change. So that's, I mean, an incredible opportunity. And I believe Google also had this major breakthrough with the ability to either read proteins, and it has to do with the discovery of like meds and being able to, I know genetics is a big thing and healthcare is meant for some disruption in that avenue. And Google had a major breakthrough with their health arm of the business. So, I mean, there are a lot of things that are setting up to make Google an incredible company. So would you say that Google is a company that you're bullish on, or is there any other company that piques your interest right now? If you had to pick one.
Yeah, if I got to pick one, I'm picking Google. It is the, what I would consider the safest bet, because I'm going off of what we know, right? So we know we have X amount of vaccines. We know people are itching to travel. We know that people have to advertise to get the word out there. It is hard. It's, as a business owner, you know yourself, it's hard to get a lot of traffic and attention and sales if you're not saying anything about it. You don't have any sort of traffic or anything out there. So I think, you know, it's hard not to use them. It's even Google Flights, you know, like anything that you need to figure out what to do and where you want to go, they're going to be in that space. Not to mention they have a competitor with Zoom, with Google Meet. I mean, what don't they have? They bought Fitbit not too long ago. They got the Android phones. I mean, it's really hard to lose. But again, it's that digital ads that is going to be the biggest player, and it's always been their biggest revenue generator. And the fact that you can win without that, and you're adding additional piece, I mean, man, it's, again, hard to lose.
What would you say to the person who says, what about the lawsuit? You know, it's anti-competitive lawsuit.
The antitrust,
Yeah.
Well, I was about to say, what lawsuit?
Because the market doesn't care, right? I heard the same thing happen to
Microsoft.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's kind of how I look. Is, you know, it happened to Microsoft back in the day. They're fine. I would also say that it could take years for that to play out. And to me, there is no point in worrying about, oh, there's this lawsuit that could come down between now and 2025. Mm-hmm. I could be making money between now and 2025, and I can worry about that, you know, when it gets here. I can put a stop loss or whatever it is. But I've got a good time for me to make money and then consider that at that point. But there's just so much we don't know about the lawsuit. I don't have a law degree, so I'm not going to really try to analyze something that I, one, don't know when it's going to happen. But also, I've already seen what has happened to other companies like Microsoft, and they've been totally fine since then.
Brother, we're getting to the most exciting part of our discussion today. What do you say to someone who comes to you and says, what is Bitcoin? So I I'm not expecting you to get all like technical, like literally someone walks up to you, they're like, hey Kevin, I know that now you've changed your views on Bitcoin, and I'm gonna get to that next, but someone approaches you and they are clueless about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin, and they say, Kevin, what's Bitcoin?
Yeah, I think it's digital currency. It is, you know, it's just digital money. That's all it really is when you really, really boil it down to it without getting into the whole blockchain and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's what it is. You can use it to buy a Tesla now. you can use it to buy several things at this point. But that's basically what it is. It's being used as an investment, and it's, you know, it's been very profitable. I'll say that.
Yeah. So the person is asking, why does it go up? How come it goes up? Like, it's been averaging about 200% return year over year for the past like 10 to 12 years. Why does it go up if it's just a currency? What do you tell the person?
I mean, that's a tough one, because at the end of the day, it's really the belief that it's going to continue to rise is why people continue to buy it. Recently, though, I would say within the last maybe 1 to 2 years, the reason why it's going up is because it's being adopted more. So you've got Square and PayPal. You had Elon Musk come out and buy $1.5 billion on the balance sheet for Tesla. It's being, again, adopted more, where you can use it for more things. It's becoming more useful. And some of these bigger institutional players are buying it and owning it as an investment as well, which gives regular investors kind of the green light. Because if a Square owns it, if Tesla owns it, if Bitcoin and JP Morgan own it, then it must be something I should look into, right? So because of these bigger players are getting into it now, it makes it a little more stable, a bit more acceptable And now you're starting to get that wide adoption that people were expecting years ago. But now we're actually starting to see that. So that's another reason why it's going up.
How did you feel comfortable? Because most people might not know this, but anytime I post about Bitcoin, I still feel a little bit uncomfortable. It's not going to be apparent through my social media, but there's a little bit of uncomfort there because it's really a gray area, right? And there is some layer of risk associated with it. So how did you get at least comfortable to post about it? And the reason I post about it, despite some level of uncertainty, being that it's an investment that is more on the higher end of the risk spectrum. But because of that higher end of the risk spectrum, that's why you're seeing those type of gains, if you will, and also losses when there's a pullback. But how did you get comfortable speaking and you know, sharing about Bitcoin? What got you to that point?
Yeah, and again, if y'all go back to the 2017, 2018, you can go back and watch the videos. And I was very critical of Bitcoin at that point in time. But we know more now than what we did 3 or 4 years ago. And I think everyone should be in a position where you get more information, you adjust your opinion for that. But for me, I don't consider myself the most aggressive investor, but I'm someone, I like to see proof. You got to show me the money before I start to invest in things. I like to see where institutions are putting their money. And then I'm like, oh, you put, you know, $250 billion in something, maybe I should go look, right? Once I started to see the PayPal, the Squares, we know Coinbase is going public later this year, and started to see, okay, this is not a fluke. This is not something that was just a mistake. It wasn't just a bubble. It's something that's becoming more legitimate. And once I started to see signals of that, that's when I said, okay, I feel comfortable putting a small portion of my money in something like this. But we do have to realize, and I think we're probably on the same page, it's still a commodity. So if Dr. Hines has one Bitcoin and I have one, you can't tell the difference between the two. But if he invested in Microsoft and I'm investing in Google, we can look at their revenue. We can understand what the CEO is trying to do. We can understand the products, and it makes it easier for me to really evaluate the value of something. For Bitcoin, we really can't do that. We can speculate, right? But there is no, this Bitcoin is doing well because it has a new CEO or it's making more revenue. None of that stuff is there. It only goes up because more people are buying it. And when more people stop buying it, then it drops. We saw that in 2017, 2018. So there is a bigger risk, but because of this wider adoption, it makes more sense. There is a limited supply, which is always a good thing because that supply and demand is going to be there. So it makes more sense now. I have a small allocation that I will continue putting a little bit in. So you do want to be careful, but based on what we know now in 2021, it makes a lot more sense than what it did in 2017.
Yeah. To the initial question that I'd asked you, if someone came to me and was like, hey, Hans, what is Bitcoin? The immediate answer that comes to my mind is it's a way to store value, or, you know, it's like digital gold, right? And the person is like, well, why is it going up? It's going up because there's a limited quantity of it. And people want it, okay? When there's a ton of demand, when people want something and everyone can get it, the price goes up. Like, it's pretty much simple. If you think about it, there are 21 million Bitcoins which will ever be in existence. Currently, I believe they've mined about 18.6 or 18.5 million. So for the next, let's say, 100 years, because the last Bitcoin will be mined in 2140. So let's just estimate that for the next 100 years, it's about 100 and something years. But for the next couple of years, only about 2.4 million Bitcoin will be mined. So the 18 million that's been mined already is already in circulation. You're looking at an asset that only 2.5 million will be mined moving forward. But at the same time, if a lot of people start coming into the space, you have less of a supply. It has to go up. But to Kevin's point, that's where it becomes a bit of a challenge. The moment where people say, I don't want to hold Bitcoin anymore, right? That's when everything begins to unravel. So at the end of the day, Bitcoin's price is based on the adoption, right? Or individuals actually putting money into Bitcoin. And I've been thinking about this week, and I want to get your thoughts, Kevin. Mm-hmm. I view Bitcoin as literally a pot of money. And it's like you've bought your piece of it and your money is now a part of it. And as people put their money into the pot, the value increases. So then you are literally sharing the pot of money as people are putting more money into it. So let's say tomorrow, this is a hyperbole, like, you know, an exaggerated description. But tomorrow, if someone puts $1 trillion into Bitcoin, and currently Bitcoin is worth $1 trillion, the value is going to double. So the money that I've put into it, it just doubles because there's now more money in the pot, which is a crazy thing to think about. Because at the end of the day, the value of Bitcoin is based on the fact that people are going to put money into it. And the more money they put into it, the more my money grows.
Yeah. And it's like, I forget what they say. It's only worth what the last person is willing to pay for it. And that's it. So people are willing to pay $52,000 or whatever it is today. And like, because in the minds of most, they think $100,000 is where it's going to go to. And if that's the case, $52,000 is a great price if you know it's going to go that high. So that's the difference. Now, if you told me that it's only going to go to 60, you know, that really depends. And it's super difficult to determine where something like that is going to go. But again, like you said, it's averaging 200%. It what was it last this time last year, like 10,000 or something crazy?
Yeah.
So it was to go
like anywhere between 5 to 10K. Yeah.
Yeah. So to go from anywhere between 5 to 10K to 50, you know, and it's something that's been around since like 2009 or so. And then you start seeing some of the world's wealthiest people and wealthiest banks jump into it too. And these are the same people, by the way, like Jamie Dimon, CEO of JP Morgan, was like, no, I would never do that. Look at him now, right? So look at me. So, you know, so those people are changing their minds. I've changed my mind. We have more information. And again, I think it makes more sense now. But also, just like we saw a lot of this talk in 2017, 2018, when it shot, I don't know, 10 or 20, 15,000, whatever the number was, and it immediately crashed. Months later, we saw a miniature crash not too long ago, a few weeks ago. So it is risky. I'll just throw it out there. But it does make more sense. We have more information. And I think in terms of safety, it is safer now than what it was just a few years ago.
Yeah. And I heard Fidelity just threw in their towel into the kind of like, you know, bucket, if you will.
Yeah. They're looking to launch an ETF. They put in their S-1 for the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, which, so like conceptually, right? Remember, Fidelity is one of the top two or three biggest brokerage firms out there. They manage trillions of dollars. I know we said the word trillion a lot today, but I mean, some of the biggest 401ks, like for example, if you worked somewhere, you probably had a Fidelity or Vanguard, you've moved, you've transferred the money into an IRA, and now you have the option to buy a Bitcoin ETF. The access, right? That's what it is. Coinbase doesn't have the access to that type of money. Cash App, where you can buy Bitcoin, doesn't have the access to that type of money. So my old 401ks, you're telling me I have the option to put, you know, 50, 60, 70,000 in Bitcoin and only still be a small source of my overall wealth? That's a huge deal, assuming it gets approved, because that's still a hurdle that you have to go through.
Yeah. The unique thing that they are doing specifically for Fidelity is that they are linking their new ETF to their index of the of Bitcoin. And I know that that was one of the core things that the SEC looked at and declined the application, because the SEC was like, how are you tracking the value of you know, the Bitcoin. So I viewed the application as being very strong as compared to the others. But Canada approved a Bitcoin ETF. I feel there's a lot of pressure on the US to follow suit.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see which ETF gets the approval. But just like when Tesla was added to the S&P 500 and it shot up about 50% or so, we might see Bitcoin fly to the moon.
Hey, look, I wouldn't mind it.
If it gets an ETF approved, I mean, that will bring a ton of institutional money, right? That, I mean, we're not even talking just retail investors. A Bitcoin ETF approval, I can see that as the main driver taking Bitcoin from, and this is a personal opinion, you know, we're not predicting the future. We don't have crystal balls. But I view this as, if a Bitcoin ETF is approved, it could be the driver over the next several months, taking Bitcoin from 50K to 100K. At that 100K point, to your point, there could be some resistance or some profit taking, right? Some people might want to take some money off the table. And we could see a pullback, who knows? But it would be very interesting if they get approved for an ETF.
Yeah, definitely. I have my eye on that one. It'll be very, very interesting if it is approved. And I mean, the access level, the interest level, and the other thing I'll say that really changed how I look at it and, you know, what kind of became a light bulb for me is I started to see financial planners start to ask the question of how much should I allocate into my client's portfolio for this? Because that community can be very, very strict on what you can and can't do and what you should and should not do. So the fact that it was a broader conversation about how much did you put in someone's portfolio, these are, you know, the retirement expert, certified financial planner, like this is where you go to for that type of stuff. The fact that they are now talking about it, so on their radar, is saying that it is a real thing that people are considering. Because I guarantee you that conversation was not happening a few years ago.
It definitely wasn't. Brother, two quick questions, and I appreciate you for coming on, sharing all of this information with my audience. First one, Cathie Wood released a $3,000 Tesla price target, and that's for 2025. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but by 2025, so about 4 years from now, what is your target price for Tesla? And what do you think about Cathie Wood's target price?
Whew. So I'll start with her. I think she's excellent. She has done incredibly well for the last few years. I can't say that I'm on board with a $3,000 price target, even though it's over 4 years. But the reason why is there's one, there's an increased competition that Tesla has not seen before. So that's a concern. Tesla just is going through a few things in China now, if I'm not mistaken, about security and whether or not their vehicles be allowed, I think because of the camera or something like that, right?
Yeah, for the government agents mm-hmm. or on like bases and things like that. China is worried about theft, you know, with the Tesla cameras stealing their information. You're right.
So,
and that can expand. You're right. Because right now they are saying government agencies shouldn't use the car. What if they decide to say, well, people who work at different corporations shouldn't use their car, or it could expand.
Right. And that's one of their biggest markets or biggest potential markets. So I can't say that I would go that high, but you could also have a split between them too. So that's something you also have to throw out there. So I can't say that I'm on board with it. Again, if it goes there, I am more than happy about that. And for me, I generally don't, it's hard for me to put the further out you go, the harder it is to predict the future when it comes to an individual stock. So yeah, I think, what is the price right now?
So the price right now is about 620, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so based on what we know, and this year has been relatively rough, I mean, I can see 12 between now and 2023. So like, mm-hmm. you know, 2022, 2023, I could definitely see that. Mm. 3,000 is still hard to come by. But again, there's just so much between now and then. But it's really the increased competition that concerns me. The China thing concerns me. I don't think Nikola is a real competitor. but you got Revion that's supposed to come out later this year.
Yeah, Amazon.
You got Ford and their partnerships. And then you've got General Motors too. Now, they haven't done all that well so far, you know, to Tesla's defense. So we'll see. We'll definitely see.
Yeah. Today I heard that the ex-CEO of IBM, Meg, is joining GM's board, which I was like, man, GM is really trying to position themselves as like a serious EV player. I don't have a lot of GM, but I started putting some money into GM a couple of months ago.
Got to diversify. I've had my 100%. Eye on Ford, and it's weird Ford. Because
Ford has been growing also.
It has. It's just weird because prior to now, Ford was like the worst.
I agree. It had a low stock price, but no prospects for growth. And all of a sudden, they're like, hey, we're an EV company, and I'm like, okay, sure.
which is so funny. It came out with the electric Mustang and the new Bronco, so I actually had an old slide. I have to redo it now because I used to make fun of Ford in my presentations for the last like year and a half. I guarantee you, I'm like, this stock is terrible. Guess what stock it is? It's Ford. And now it's like, you know, Ford might not be so bad right now.
I know. The growth has been even shocking, in all honesty. Yeah. Brother, the very last question that I have for you. Man, those student loans, are they going to forgive those student loans? What's going up with this administration?
Look, they owe me some money. I don't see that, right? Like, In reality, it is early. It has not been 90 days. Okay. You know, I really shouldn't be upset that my loans are still here. However, I've also seen how quickly other things have been passed. And I felt like we were pretty loud and clear that we wanted these wiped away. so my guess is that at some point, it better be this year, but at some point there will be maybe it's the smaller, like $10,000 forgiveness. I do imagine there are going to be a lot of loopholes, either applications or you have to do something specific to do that. I could definitely see that. I think he's more on board with that. I don't think we're going to see the full $50,000 or full cancellation for everyone, which is the dream, but he never actually said that. So that's the thing. I also don't know. I think this is really going to depend on the filibuster situation. And whether or not they're going to retain that. As long as the filibuster is there, I don't think we're going to get a lot of the bigger pie in the sky stuff that people were asking for. So that's what we're going to see there. But he owed me $10K at minimum. So that I will retweet it every day until I get my money.
Brother, I love your post. Anytime I see it, you're like, where's my money?
Absolutely.
Facts. And for everyone listening, another thing that I know for sure also is that they are going to, you know, tweak the student loan program so that even if they don't give like the full like loan forgiveness, right, they might have other programs like the public service loan forgiveness or like the income-based repayment programs, which also have loan forgiveness. And they could improve on those programs, right? Perhaps they can make the, you know, the income-based repayments, the amount when it's forgiven is taxed. Maybe they can make it non-taxable.
Well, I think they actually snuck that into the last stimulus package. I think it was Lynette Calfani-Cox. I think she had tweeted that out. She's a financial expert as well and used to be a reporter at CNBC, if I'm not mistaken. So she did an in-depth analysis on it. If I'm not mistaken, I think they did take that out. So if you are, if it ever comes down, you won't be taxed in the way that you used to for it. So which is kind of like sets the stage that is a big deal.
If they snuck that in the COVID package, brother, that is huge.
Yeah,
because absolutely. Most individuals don't know that anyone qualifies for loan forgiveness. It's just that it takes a while, right? Mm-hmm. With public service loan forgiveness, it's 10 years. With income-based repayment, if it's undergrad, it's 20 years. If it's grad student loans, it's 25. Hey, I'm hoping they kind of reduce that, right? Maybe 15, maybe 10, you know, maybe 5.
Give it 5. But I also want to know how long they're going to, and they extended it recently. I don't know what the deadline is. I wonder how long they're going to keep the no interest, no payments. It gives people an option to say, look, I'm definitely going to invest more, but maybe I can also knock down some of this debt at the same time. Because mostly with that interest, you really don't see that balance go down as much. But without that interest, you can like, oh, I'm actually making some headway here. So I wonder how many people are taking advantage of that and how long that's going to last too.
Brother, I know we started with this question, but I want to ask it again. For a new investor who's sitting right now looking at their portfolio in red, because of the expectation that they set in their mind coming into 2021, what do you have to say to them?
I would say, look at your portfolio statement from this time last year, because if you compare March 2020 to March 2021, if you were investing at that point in time, you were up significantly. Like we thought this time last year, this is the worst thing we had ever seen since 2008. Like we thought we were going into depression and we weren't. So remember what happened last year. And doesn't mean it's going to be a repeat, but take your time. Like don't make, we're not even 90 days into 2021. So relax, take your time. And this is a long-term game. It's not fun to see your portfolio in the red for the last 3-4 weeks. But remember this, the whole year and over in 3 or 4 weeks, right? So this is a long-term game. You didn't get here, Dr. Hines, within 4 weeks, and neither did I. It took some time, and there were a lot of red days, but it's because of that consistent investing and choosing quality companies and index funds that is going to make you successful. And just like I said, all of 2020, those who are investing now are going to be the ones that are going to be wealthy in 2022. Like that's where the money is. 5 years from now, you're going to wish you started now. And that's the key thing.
100%. Brother, I want to thank you so much for taking the time. You know, I've never really told you this, but the way that I knew about you was on Twitter. I used to follow. Yeah, absolutely. I used to follow you. I was like, man, this guy has so many features, like, you know, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Business Insider. I was like, man. And fast forward today, you know, I can call you a friend. So, man, I appreciate you. Been following your work for like a number of years, right? So just wanted to let you know I appreciate your friendship and just also appreciate what you do for our community and the students that you serve, because you know it very well. No one was coming into our community to educate us about how to build wealth. No one, right? I mean, they just didn't even care. But, you know, now we have the opportunity to be able to pass on and share the knowledge that we have so that we can help our community, this generation, right? Underrepresented groups. For me, I count underrepresented groups as, you know, immigrants, minorities, some millennials as well, because some millennials didn't grow up in wealthy households. Mm-hmm. And even for them, if, you know, you didn't grow up in a wealthy household, no matter your race, the system didn't care about you. They weren't coming to share the secrets of wealth building with you either. Right. So this is the leveling of the playing field. Everyone has a smartphone and everyone can get on like a Cash App or a Robinhood or a Public or, you know, a Fidelity or a Charles Schwab or a Vanguard. It's just a phenomenal time. And it's great to see that, man, we are on the field helping to bring more players on board. And it's, brother, such an honor to get the opportunity to not necessarily work with you, but you get what I mean, right? To be on the same field.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I remember when you had actually put out that stat about the number of particularly African-Americans who had never invested before. Like, I felt that you were a huge part of that. And I'm like, I'm glad to know this guy. I'm glad that we collectively have helped, you know, we can't claim the entire part of it, maybe just a sliver, right? But the fact that we have been able to push the needle and make sure that people see people like us and hear the story of immigrants who have come here and started to invest, and just everybody has a place here. I think it's just so important. And I'm glad and proud of the work that you do. And I'm glad to be here. So thank you again.
Likewise, brother. Thank you.